Why is celebrating failure in life science just as important as celebrating success? How do you make the psychological shift from being one expert among many in the room to being a leader of experts? And what does a near industry-wide clinical failure have to do with a potential new treatment for 500 million osteoarthritis patients? Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys of life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. Today, I'm joined by Elliot Forster, CEO of Levicept, based just south of Oxford in the UK. They're looking into novel treatments for the signs and symptoms of osteoarthritis. We'll talk more about the science at the end of the episode, but first, Elliot, thank you so much for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure. And again, thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
Always a pleasure. Elliot, you've had an amazing career so far. For full transparency, we've spoken before. You've had a great career rising through GSK and Pfizer. You've had your first of many CEO roles with Solace Pharmaceuticals, and you've served as CEO, and I've got the list here, and it is a list. Creabilis, Immunocore, F-Star, which is where we first spoke, and now with Levicept. And you're hosting your own podcast, The Life Sci Fantastic. So a lot going on. But my first question for you is to take you back to Solace Pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And why did you decide to become a CEO? What was that decision point for you like?
Yeah, well, I'd spent 15 years in big pharma, predominantly in the clinical development space. And as you said, I'd made some sort of reasonable career progress through there. But I got to a point where I could have continued and was having a really excellent time at Pfizer, which was my last big pharma company. But I sort of got the urge to test myself in what at the time I described as being the other side of the table. And the other side of the table because in big pharma, we're constantly meeting biotechs and biotech teams with the new technology and exciting technology. And they were always on the other side of the table. And I wondered what it would be like to be on that side of the table rather than the big pharma side of the table. And so I went out to explore that. I was lucky enough to be asked when I began that exploration to speak to a handful of companies, one of which was Solace Pharmaceuticals. And they were talking to me about going in with the US, because it was a US-based biotech startup, with the sort of non-diploma of president and CEO. And I wasn't sure what that was about. I'd never been anything like that before, of course, in my past. And so I reached out to a friend and a colleague of mine, Peter Chambray, who'd been the CEO of Cambridge Antibody Technologies. Peter and I, by the way, work together still on the board of Immatics. And I sat down with Peter and said, what should I do? And in essence, the choice was between another R&D role or CEO. And he, just to paraphrase, said, well, what do you want to be? He said, well, I said, ultimately, I want to be a CEO. He said, then be a CEO. And that was it. And so I pursued that with Solace Pharmaceuticals. And it was a really interesting experience. I was learning something new about once every 20 minutes. I really had no, it's actually scary when I look back and I, you know, beg forgiveness for the Solace Pharmaceuticals investors and board members who were terrifically supportive. I was just making it up. I had a great colleague in the shape of Kevin Pajacic, and we basically, you know, ran the company together in its early days. And Kevin is now a successful CEO in his own right, of course. And that was that. And so I became a CEO. And as you said, for reasons best known to the world, I'm now in my fifth one of those, a really great company and great technology in the shape of Levicept. But hopefully we cover a bit of that off later.
We will. I like what you said, that you had this choice between an R&D role and then the CEO. So it sounds like, and that ultimately you did want to become a CEO. I'd love to know, when did you decide in your life that you were going to step up to lead?
So I guess by dint of accident, either of birth or background or education or something, I've always found myself as being the chippy person in a group. So again, I ended up doing weird things like captaining, you know, rugby teams. And I always ended up being the guy who was made leader of different things at school and then in the social world as well. And so there was a kind of part of me that got used to the idea of working with people in a friendly way to coordinate activities, whether it be tossing a coin at the beginning of a match to see which end we should play at, you know, into the rain or out of the rain type of thing in rugby. So I always had this sort of underlying sense of being comfortable in a focused role. I would never have described it as a leadership role, but a focused role where others would turn for decisions and, you know, working together, we'd make courses of action that we thought would be successful. And that was in a very, very small way. So I wasn't uncomfortable with the idea of what we would now call leadership. I guess the moment for me that I, and this may be a reimagination of a lot of circumstances coming together as one, but I remember sitting on the back of a bus which was transporting me to the car park from the Pfizer site down in Sandwich when I was there, and looking around at everyone else in the bus and thinking about myself on the bus and thinking that I wanted to make an impact. I didn't just want to describe my career as the things that I was doing in order to get to a particular role of leadership. And at the time, I envisaged myself as being CEO of Pfizer, believe it or not. Which is crazy, but I didn't want my journey to be one of that journey. I wanted to be the impact I made in that leadership organization and in the leadership of that organization. And so I knew I had to get to a leadership role as soon as possible in order to have the impact, if you get what I mean. It's a kind of weird framework, but that was genuinely how I was thinking about it. And so when the opportunity arose for Solace, it struck me that there was an opportunity to do something that was terrifying and exciting simultaneously, because I really didn't know. I knew how to develop drugs and what it took, but I didn't know anything about running a biotech organization, raising money, dealing with boards, anything at all. I had to learn all of that and ask people around me for help on a very frequent basis. That was probably terrifying to them.
I think you touched on a number of challenges there that we'll expand on in a minute, but I'd love to know, were there any personal challenges that you faced on your leadership journey?
Well, for those who are in sort of C-suite roles, particularly in biotechs and in particular CEOs, they will know it's an unforgiving, remorseless and unremitting workload, because it, in smaller companies, I'm sure it's true in very large companies also, it is the central point of focus, of decisions, of activities, of communication, of guidance. And so it's, you're on all the time, and CEOs need to live in the future. So not only are you dealing with the present, but you're living in a future which may be 6 months, maybe 6 years ahead of where you are now, so that you can prepare the organization as best you can for that future that you've envisaged and do things today that will allow that future to occur. And all of that then has an enormous impact in terms of time, but really importantly, intellectual time. And because of the international nature of biotech, often in terms of travel as well. And so the personal impact for me was that I spent only fractions of the time I should have and wanted to spend with my growing family, with my wife. Almost unthinkingly, I just made that trade-off because I was in the role, I was committed to it, and that was the trade-off. And you know, fortunately, those around me were, I guess, understanding and forgiving of that. And, you know, I've now emerged with more experience where I can achieve the same things, but need a little less bandwidth to do it, just because of experience.
As you said, it affects everybody, and you have your own personal story with this. I'd love to know if you have one little nugget of advice to those first-time CEOs who find themselves overwhelmed with the amount of work, and that trade-off of like work and life is not as optimal, maybe, as they would like.
So it's be organized. So it's very, very easy to allow a diary to dominate your entire existence. And if it is a fluid diary over which you don't take any prospective control, so next Tuesday I need a gym slot at 8:30, then that gym slot just disappears. And so actually just being organized can create the space and freedom to operate. So for example, that is something that I've adopted. I guess we'd need others to say whether I'd been successful or not, but that's for others to talk about. But I am going to the gym at 8:30 next Tuesday. And then the other thing that I do in this kind of modern age of having a supercomputer in our pocket is I don't take my phone into my bedroom. So it's literally switched off. It's nowhere near. I can't hear it. I can't see it. And so I do have a period of being away from the office, as it were, at least during the hours of darkness while I'm in bed or asleep.
Wow, that's great advice, I think. Mm. And just kind of going back to these shared challenges with other life science leaders, I'd love you to expand on just some of the challenges, I think, today that affect leaders like yourself in the life science space.
Well, for a start, the environment in terms of number of players is much, much bigger. I first started raising money in 2006. And at that time, there were many investors, of course, but only a fraction. I suspect it's probably 25 or 30% of the total that we have today. And so it was just kind of easier to get around and to get to know people who are in that environment and who the key players were and what their particular preferences are. I would say one of the challenges today is understanding and getting to grips with the sheer scale of the community investors that are available all around the world. And again, in those days, as it were, although it's still dominated by the US, there are now some really significant investors in Europe. There are, in Asia, particularly out of China, more and more investors coming through. And I think that's one challenge. So you really need to be on top of why you're raising capital, what you're going to do with it ultimately, and then targeting, those players who you believe will fulfill that requirement for you. So I think that's one thing. And then the second is to get as good a team around you as you possibly can. I've always said in my role as a CEO, my ambition is to increasingly do less. And the only way you can do that is to have great people working with you.
I think that's a great point. And something that we try and strive for in Life Science Org is that very rare thing for CEOs, that peer-to-peer learning from each other. But it sounds like you've surrounded yourself with good people throughout your career to not only delegate to, but to learn from as you've grown. I'd like to know, have you learned a very valuable lesson from a peer or from a colleague that formal education just couldn't possibly have taught you?
There are so many. If I go back to my Pfizer days where I was becoming more and more senior in the organization and had leadership responsibilities, if you like, one of the big transitions that one has to make in that setting is moving from being amongst peers to becoming the manager leader of that peer right. group. And of course, we all come in to an organization as either experts or single topic contributors, and you have to move from that as a platform to being a generalist. And one of the mistakes I think that some leaders make is they never give up that desire to continue to be the expert. It's comforting in some ways because you know more than everyone else about a particular subject, and that's the point of comfort and the point of significance for the individual. I think the hard transition is moving away from that. Many would argue it was easy for me because, of course, I was expert in nothing to start with. So that was the least difficult transition of all time. But that is a transition. And being able then to work with those people who will be your peers, friends, and colleagues as a leader and make decisions about them and about their output in a different sort of way is a tough transition. And I would say that for the first time that occurred to me in Pfizer, and there were individuals in that peer group who were just superb because they also understood that the relationship was going to be different, but they didn't treat me differently. What they did is they just recognized that I had a new set of responsibilities. Those responsibilities were different than the ones I had yesterday, and that their responsibilities, therefore, were to support me and be successful, continue to be successful in their own roles. So I think that sort of social interaction, if you like, in the professional setting was important. And then people pointing out, so that there's a very old friend of mine and colleague, a guy called James Sandy, I'll name him, who I work with and have worked with for many, many years. And he's a superb drug developer, statistician by training, but really superb drug developer. And we were once sitting on an airplane heading to Chicago, and I'd been in a leadership role in Pfizer for a long time. And during the course of the flight, it's a long flight, he turned to me and he said, "How's it going?" Boom, boom, and I chit-chat. He said, "Yeah." He said, "How do you think the team are doing?" And I was, "Well, I think they're okay," et cetera. He said, "When was the last time you went out and had a beer with one of them or got them together to just celebrate the successes we've had?" And of course, the answer was never. And what he was saying to me is, you've got to bring everyone with you, not just in terms of work output, which of course we were doing, and we were actually a very successful part of that organization. But we've also got to continue to remember that we need to mark success. We need to collectively acknowledge what we've done, well or badly. And that for me was a really valuable lesson, and I've never forgotten about it. And in fact, you know, I still continue to make sure there is a acknowledgement, social acknowledgement aspect to most of the things that I do, because it is important. And that's just one example. There are many, many lessons along the way. And I would generally say what most people will find is when they get into a leadership position is they'll find that people will always be able to do the thing that they've been asked to do much better than you can. So I'm always staggered by the quality, not because I don't have respect or expectation of the people who are doing the work, but I'm always staggered by the quality of work that comes, and reflect and say that not in 100 years could I have produced anything anywhere near as good as that. And so therefore I'm grateful for the people who I'm working with and surrounded by.
This has come up before in life science org, where a leader has told me that they celebrate the wins, but they also celebrate the losses with their team. You know, if a project doesn't work out and they have to shut it down, they still go out for drinks to celebrate that the work was done.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that is important, because in our industry, mainly most people will only get the chance to celebrate failure. We do our product development by experimentation. And therefore, we don't know what the outcome is going to be. And we can all tell tales, and we see every day in the industry press that things fail. We've seen a couple of, you know, significant phase three failures from Big Pharma over the last 24 hours. And so we've got, I think, in particular in our industry, to recognize that despite good work being done and best efforts being made, sometimes the biology or the chemistry just doesn't work, and that's how it goes. And to some extent, when we get to the Levicep story, you know, the Levicep story is a phoenix that came from the flame from a whole industry-wide failure with respect to anti-nerve growth factor molecules for the treatment of OA. And there was nothing wrong with the work that had been done. It's just the full understanding of the underlying biology was missing. I can't help but express, however, the bell that's going off in the back of my head. And the bell that's going off in the back of my head is, yes, all of that is true, but. And the but part is that ultimately our job is really, really simple. What we've got to do is take an idea to fix a problem in the clinic using a therapeutic, and convert that idea into that therapeutic and then deliver that to patients. It's unbelievably difficult to do it, but actually the principle is simple. And although celebrating a failure is the right thing to do, it needs to understand why we failed, and it needs to then create a greater opportunity for us to be successful next time, because we only survive on the products that we produce, and the patients only benefit from the products we produce. They don't benefit from the things that didn't make it.
That's very true. Before we talk about this amazing Phoenix story that I'm even more excited for, before we talk about Levicep, what do you find particularly exciting or inspiring about European life science for leaders like yourself today?
Well, we reflected on this a little earlier. So when I first started out, there were only a handful of relatively small investors, and therefore the ecosystem in Europe was just not as good as it is today. I suspect there were the same sort of number of startups per capita going on at that time, and there were some very good entrepreneurs and good funders who were getting together. But the quanta of capital available, in particular in Europe, less so in the UK, but in particular if you go into mainland Europe, and in particular if you go into the Netherlands, you know, that quanta of capital is really transformational. And it enables companies now to move, and not just through the, you know, the idea to proof of concept stage, but develop programs beyond that into the clinic and really create opportunities. And I hope that we'll see more companies. So Argenx is a really good example, but more companies that grow up to be a multi-billion business that is sustaining our life science community, because once companies get to that size, they'll invest in smaller companies, they'll continue and invest in product to people. And I'm excited about the future because of that. And it's a kind of weird focus on capital, but I think capital is the thing that's being missing in truth for us. And we still have the weakness of home markets. So one of the great strengths of US biotech and pharma is they've got a great market for their products in the US. One of the strengths historically of Japan was they had a great market for their products in Japan. Europe continues to be laggards with respect to what we're willing to pay for innovation. And that will always be a anchor weighing down the true ability of companies to break through and become, you know, the next Argenx or the next Genzyme or the next GSK, as it were. So you know, maybe that gets fixed, maybe it doesn't. But nonetheless, optimistically, I think the level of investment capital up to that point really creates opportunities for us. I think that's one thing. And then the other, which I'm really excited about, is we've now got the second generation of entrepreneurs. We've got the second generation of investors. We've got the second generation of professional services in biotech in Europe who have learned from the mistakes of the past. They've learned from what's good and the right thing to do in the past. And I think that ecosystem is just getting stronger and stronger. And a little tell that everyone believes that is the number of US funds, because they're always the lead indicators, that are beginning to appear in European shores is really interesting. So, you know, OrbiMed have set up operation now in Europe, for example, under Dina Chea, and, you know, put senior people who are very competent and experienced have landed on our shores, as it were. And so that's a good sign as well. I'm pretty optimistic about it. We've got to stay focused on delivering, got to keep government support. So lobby organizations like ABPI in the UK, BIA in the UK, and the equivalents need to keep up their good work, because we can't afford to let the gains we've had slip. But I'm pretty optimistic, and I'm seeing some really cool tech beginning to appear. And when we've got past the fluff of AI in our industry, because there's quite a lot of fluff at the moment, but once we get down to, you know, real how we use machine learning properly in terms of as another tool to benefit our ability to give us a better chance of getting the right outcome from our experiments, then I think we're in a very strong position, because we've got a superb foundation in IT infrastructure, IT people. And I think that's a real opportunity for the future for us.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a real convergence of technology and investment happening now in Europe, which is making it very exciting.
Yes.
Given everything we've discussed up till now, tell me finally about Levicept. Tell me about the unmet need that you're facing and why now is the time to tackle it.
Osteoarthritis is one of the most prevalent conditions on the planet. There are about 500 million people who've got osteoarthritis. The World Health Organization forecasts that by the middle of this century, there'll be about 1 billion people with osteoarthritis. Much of it, which is tractable to modern medicine, modern healthcare systems, but also much of it, which is not. And what has been happening is over the decades, lots and lots of different people have tried different ways to tackle osteoarthritis. And osteoarthritis is a long-term degenerative disease, lasts over decades. And ultimately in the West, if it's a large joint, so a knee or a hip, for example, the ultimate outcome is to have that joint replaced. But that's a significant intervention. It's a significant intervention for the individual, because if they're elderly, then there are risks associated with major traumatic surgery, of course. But it's also a risk for the economy, because we leave, because there are so few, relatively so few joint replacements, we leave a huge portion of the populace isolated in trying to deal with drugs that really don't work. I was fortunate enough to be responsible for the development of the COX-2 inhibitors, in part back in the 1990s. We had some benefits there, but again, they are a mechanism a lot like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that work for a little while, but are associated with some side effects and leave patients dissatisfied. And I think one of the most obvious impacts of this lack of therapy is the role that has been played by the opiates and OxyContin in particular, where it was used a lot for osteoarthritis. It doesn't work in osteoarthritis. And we know the damaging sequelae of that. So there's a real opportunity to treat osteoarthritis symptomatically and in terms of underlying disease. And the first big attempt, a new attempt was made using antibodies to a neurotrophin called nerve growth factor. Nerve growth factor is one of four neurotrophins and is the best characterized and best known Nobel Prize associated with the discovery and so on. And as an industry, we made some wonderful high potency switch off the nerve growth factor pathway entirely. And what we saw was that we got great analgesia. Unfortunately, nerve growth factor is a small amount of nerve growth factor is required in the background to maintain joint architecture. And so what was happening is we were not getting pain. And in some patients, and in some cases, as many as a quarter of patients, the architecture of the joint was failing in the background, undetected, of course, because there was still analgesia. And so ultimately, all of those programs, and I think there were 9 in development, were put on the back burner under a long-term clinical hold. And no one's been working on those for certainly in this decade. And out of that background, coming from the discovery unit that had come up with the idea of anti-NGFs, was the founder of Levicept, a guy called Simon Westbrook. You must listen to my podcast when I interview him. A guy called Simon Westbrook, who said, actually, I think there's an alternative pathway here. There is the homeostatic control mechanism is a thing called P75NTR, it doesn't matter, but there is a homeostatic control mechanism that becomes overwhelmed in inflammation. What if we just simply supplement that control mechanism? So do more of what nature intended. And that's what Levicept has done. It's what Levi-04, our program, is. And we've just published data from our phase 2, 500 plus patient phase 2 study, and it works very, very well, just replacing that homeostatic control. So we've controlled pain and all of the other symptoms of OA. We've, in the clinic, demonstrated an improvement in the underlying disease using a well-known biomarker that can be seen using imaging. And we're very excited about the next steps for the business, in particular as we move towards phase 3 over the coming year or so, and with a view to launching the drug in this decade and making it available to all of those patients who need it.
Wow, it really is a phoenix rising from the ashes story.
It really is.
That looked like it was done, like there was nothing coming from it, and all of a sudden, victory.
Yes. It really was. And it's one of those stories of kind of mechanistic understanding. And you know, we can sometimes be guilty of believing that we know all there is to know about a particular mechanism. And only when someone like Simon steps right back and says, well, hang on a minute, that mechanism may be real, but it exists in a much broader context. Can we influence that broader context? And we fall foul of that, you know, often. I remember a very, very long time ago, when I was working in the anti-emesis space. So this is back in the GSK days. And we came up with we were using 5-HT3s to treat postoperative nausea and vomiting and chemotherapy-induced emesis, and really successful drugs, which worked very well for patients. And we were working in R&D on a new mechanism, and the commercial guy said, what are you doing? He said, well, we're coming up with this new mechanism, but we've already solved it. And we then had this, you know, fairly robust conversation about what we'd actually solved was a, you know, 15% of the total market. What we hadn't solved was the 85%, and it's probably worth continuing to concentrate on the other half. And that story keeps getting repeated. You know, if you think about checkpoint inhibitors, which are wonderful drugs for oncology, transform the face of oncology, but they only really work in about half of the patients, in truth. And so the other half are still waiting for something to come along for them. And so we've got to keep up, you know, that endeavor as well, and sort of not believe our own propaganda.
Yeah. Elliot, imagining that everything goes to plan, mm. and this is being very optimistic, what impact do you hope to create with Levicept? What does the world look like when you're successful?
We're fortunate in that we have the lens of a large phase two study to look through from a symptomatic perspective, from a tolerability perspective, and from a disease control perspective. We're making this drug in a way in which it can be delivered by the patient once a month at home using a self-injecting either auto pen or disposable pen. Now, disposable is particularly important to get into communities that don't have access to sophisticated healthcare systems, developing economies, because a farmer in Nigeria also gets OA, not just the farmer in Swindon, as it were. And so that's by the way of delivery. So I would hope that we can provide a medicine that can be used in a really simple way, will help immediately, and the time to onset of our drug is 3 days, help immediately with symptom control, so function, stiffness, make the patients feel better about that disease. But ultimately, and this is a very ambitious statement, but ultimately create a remission in osteoarthritis and the disease of osteoarthritis, enabling patients to get on for a period without need of further treatment or intervention. Now, it may be that the disease then comes back after a while and the patients come out of that remission and become refractory, and then they start treatment again. But I think if we can see a world in which we remember the bad old days of osteoarthritis in the same way as we remember the bad old days of polio, then I think we'll have done our jobs well.
That's a great goal to aim for. Finally, Elliot, thank you so much for your time, as always.
Pleasure.
But this is your podcast. Well, it's not your podcast in the Life Science Fantastic. Still my podcast. But I have one more question.
Sure.
What have we not discussed in this time that you'd like to take your last few minutes to talk about?
Wow. Okay. That's a great question. So I think the thing that is different about people who work in our sector, and I'm making great assumptions because I've only ever worked in our sector, is that we have to have optimism as a sort of pathology. We almost should develop a treatment for the optimism that we have at such a disease. But I do believe that the only way we can be successful is to continue to believe that we can make a difference on a day-to-day basis, and make a difference in the way we've just discussed Levicept's product, Levi-04. And I think from a personality perspective, an individual personality perspective, but also a collective personality perspective, we need to continue to have that optimistic pathology about the difference we can make, because there's so many things around us that would suggest we shouldn't be optimistic. The way in which society is dealing with itself in terms of utility, of social media. We may be pessimistic about that. Clearly, you know, there are wars all over the world which are very high profile. We could be pessimistic about that. We could be pessimistic about the political environment we find ourselves in. But I think overriding all of that, what we are trying to do is to help each other to have healthier lives and hopefully longer, healthier lives. And I think we need to continue to be optimistic about that. And so we haven't really talked about sentiment during the course of this, but the sentiment I'd like to drive is to be optimistic about the future for healthcare, the future for patients, and what we can achieve together.
It's a great note, I think, to end on. Thank you so much, Elliot, for your time.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm very grateful for the time you've allowed and letting me join your podcast.
And I look forward to the next season of the LifeSci Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
It's no secret that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions inspire us every week. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our life science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.